This is What Does It Profit? And I'm your host, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. If you're a regular listener, you know that our second season is now in the back catalog. And I want to take this moment to express my gratitude to Hannah, Niels, and Sean, our season two interns from Georgetown University, who manned our research team and built our show website. I'd also like to give special thanks to Chris, Julia, Kate, Peter, and Sarah from Catholic University's Masters of Science in Business program, who worked this season on the data analytics and research that will be used as the basis of the social media campaign rollouts that are coming as we launch season three. So here we are, staring down Memorial Day weekend and the beginning of what we think of as finally summer. At What Does It Profit? This means that right now we're just about ankle deep in all the work that we're going to be doing to get ready for season three in September. So here's the plan. This week and every 2 weeks throughout the summer, we're going to pull you in deeper to What Does It Profit by revisiting lessons drawn from interviews in our back catalog and sharing with you more about the heart and soul of the show through conversations I've had with fellow podcasters. This week, I'm introducing you to Adam and Vanessa, the creators and co-hosts of Uncertain Things, the super smart social commentary podcast that this year made its way to Apple Podcasts' coveted new and noteworthy category. And at the beginning of season two, I talked with Adam and Vanessa about What Does It Profit and about my journey in bringing it to you. Take a listen. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
Hi, Dawn.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Great. As we will obviously introduce you in the intro to the podcast, you are the host and I was going to say, are you also the producer?
Well, I guess I've been learning a lot about this media stuff because I didn't grow up in this world. But and so I'm learning that the person who has like the final say is the executive producer. So I guess that's what I do.
In print, you'd be the editor in chief.
Ooh, there you go.
So you're the editor in chief and host of the What Does It Profit podcast.
Yes, the lady that pays the bills.
Exactly. So tell us a little bit about this podcast.
So we wanted to find a way to differentiate the way we wanted to talk about business. We didn't want to be a marketing show or an infomercial, you know, trying to hawk something. We really wanted to look at serious stuff, but from a different angle. And so you've got business shows, particularly the more heady stuff that comes out of public media that really talks about the economic value of business. But what we do is talk about the moral and social value of business. And we call it What Does It Profit? And for those who have a theological lens, maybe familiar with this phrase, but it's this idea, and we ask all of our guests, you know, in the work that you do in the world, and that varies if you look at our guest list, what does it profit? What does it benefit? And what does it benefit you personally, but really more the common good? And so that's what we're all about.
And I saw in my research that title, What Does It Profit? When I first saw it, I was a little bit confused, actually. I was like, what does that refer to exactly? And then as I was researching, I realized it comes from a verse from the Bible, actually. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul?
Pretty heady, right?
It's great. It was a great verse.
I think it captures part of the reason that we liked your podcast and thought that it would be interesting talking to you, because our conversations so far, We are almost confusingly eclectic sometimes, because in trying to find some sound footing, we've been looking at anywhere from religious scholars to political commentators, and we felt like we've been missing the one aspect that really does shape a lot of our world, which is the economy and business. And you, in your perspective through it, kind of combined this whole gamut.
Yeah, we're like a thinking person's business podcast, deep thinking person.
What's your history in bringing this podcast about?
Yeah, how does one go about finding their way to doing something like this? Well, I started out life as an investment banker. I spent almost 25 years doing financial deals. And my clients almost exclusively during that time were social purpose organizations whose mission was either educational or cultural or civic in some way, but they needed to access the capital markets primarily for real estate projects. So we were financing museums, schools, universities, hospitals, headquarters for very large trade and cultural organizations.
Was this by chance or by pursuit that you got these kinds of clients?
Oh, well, it was by design. I started out thinking, I guess as a teenager, I was thinking about what was I going to study in college, which was a big deal for me because I was the first in my family to go to college. This will date me, but I watched the film All the President's Men. And I don't know if you remember that, but you know, those Woodward and Bernstein exposing the Watergate scandal, which seems oh so innocent these days. But I saw that and I'm like, you know what? Those guys are doing something really important. I want to be just like that. So I came to Washington to learn to be a political journalist. And, you know, it's, I don't know if any of your listeners are, you know, first generation college students, but it's a struggle. And so for me, it became a matter of practicality. I was studying political science, thinking, you know, rather, you know, it was this question, do I study political science or do I study journalism? I thought, well, I can always learn how to write, but I should know what I'm writing about. So I was studying political science and I'm like, you know what, how am I going to earn a living doing this? And I worked all through college. And one of the jobs that I had was as a corporate paralegal in this enormous law firm in Washington, D.C. So I made an awful lot of money doing that because I worked crazy hours, but I met some of what we now consider icons in finance. And I looked around the room one day and I'm like, who do I want to be when I grow up? But I'm looking around and I'm like, you know what? I've got this very expensive college education to pay for. You know, who do I want to be in this room? And I looked around and I was like, you know what? I think I want to be the banker. And it was really a moment of, it was the fork in the road. And so I've always had this interest and desire to tell stories. And I learned that that's a lot of the important work that bankers do, which is tell the stories of those who need capital to the people who have capital to invest. And so that's kind of how in my mind I made that transition.
Wait. So this is this is very counterintuitive to somebody like me hearing the word banker as a banker, as a storyteller, something that needs a little more unpacking, I think.
As investors, you have a lot of opportunities for investment. So you look at the numbers and you say, okay, well, this asset is going to give me this return. So is this asset. So how do I make a difference? How do I make a choice between this asset and this asset? Well, it's about assessing the risks. Mm. And the risks are understood through the process, you could say, of storytelling. You explain, you know, what is the reason for the existence of this entity? What is it that they're trying to achieve? What are the forces out in the world that are going to help make that happen? And what are the forces that are going to be the headwinds against that happening? And it becomes a story. That was always, for me, the most fun part of my job.
I guess we don't normally interview people from the finance world on this podcast. So it's just such a unique, is that the common understanding of the job you do?
Yes, it's like the Great Oz behind the curtain.
No, because, you know, as somebody who's really terrible at investment, it always strikes me as basically just picking the story that makes sense to you. But deep down, I always attribute that to my own ineptness in understanding really how to read the fluctuations of things. Like when I see people say something like, oh, if we go to war, it's going to impact these stock because it's going to cause these to rise and these to fall. I feel like that sounds like such a human-centric way to look at it. Whereas obviously the market itself is such a complete, like a transcendent transcendental force that we don't fully understand. It's, in my mind, always the shamans of the of Wall Street have access to much more sophisticated tools than stories. They have numbers, they have math on their side, and that is how they really evaluate things that we don't understand, things that are, you know, obviously everything comes down to evaluating human behavior, of course, but I always assume that the evaluations occur on a level that is not really narratable.
Yeah, but you know, you have to put those numbers aside at some level. I mean, think about all the companies that are out there. Just even, let's take the tech space where, you know, they're not making money. They're losing money. But we love these companies anyway. We nurture these companies. We want these companies to be successful because they have great stories. I mean, you think about the Ubers of the world. So I think that you're right. I mean, there is this mystification of, you know, the quantitative side of what goes on. And, you know, especially now with automated trading, you know, a lot of this gets done by computers, and more with AI. You know, it's the human side of it we don't so much talk about, but I believe that markets should serve humanity. I sat on a panel with a group of folks from throughout the world this past year that was convened by the Vatican. It was called The Economy of Francesco. And it's this idea of how do we look at finance as service to humanity? And there are a lot of big questions involved with that process.
At that point of you, when you decided you wanted to be the banker and you fell in love with that capacity of telling the story, where is the goal? Because already you combine two different aspects of it. Part of it is you need to tell a story in order to tell to get somebody to understand why they want to invest in one option other than the other. But you also said that we want the markets to be human, which implies some certain human values that go beyond where you want to invest in order to get your, you know, best bang for the buck.
Oh, yeah. No, good observation. For me, it was, you know, here I had come out of, I had just earned a graduate degree in political science. I was all about, you know, had this orientation of the public good. So I became a banker that focused on these types of, you know, civic and charitable organizations. And these were the really early days. This was like the early 1990s. There weren't bankers who so much focused on these specialty nonprofit organizations. And so I thought, well, I'm going to create this niche. And so I did. I was in my early 20s. I went through school really fast. I was on this terror not to be, you know, in this impoverished state of, you know, trying to get through college on my own. And I was just very determined. And so I guess I had a lot of chutzpah. You know, my boss really couldn't argue with me because here I was, this young banker bringing in deals. That's not typically the way it works. You usually carry someone's briefcase for a few years. For me, I just didn't want to waste any time.
Yeah, it's, I think it's very important to put it in the context of the time period, because it, like you're saying, like in the 90s, that wasn't a done thing, not just that your personal story about going out and seeking deals, but seeking out this niche that you wanted to carve out for yourself. And I think that now we are at a moment where that is becoming kind of the more maybe not common yet, but it's starting on that path to being the more common path forward for people. And I'm really fascinated to get into this idea of the ways that we're telling the stories are changing now, right? The ways that we're evaluating risk is completely changing. And I definitely want to dive into that. But before I do, I do want to make sure I understand from your perspective, you know, where you were coming from. Did you just have did you have the religious background? Did you have an interest in theology that was kind of driving this moral kind of path that you wanted to forge in the business world? Or was that something that came later?
Oh, that came later. And it came in a very dramatic way. I mean, I was like, do whatever it takes to get the job done. Ghost wrote a autobiography of an adult film actress. I mean, I was not sitting in the pews. that came later. Yeah, well, for me, my lens was always a little bit colored because I didn't come to this field of or this profession, you know, from a background I guess I came from a questioning background only because, you know, my parents are bar owners and, you know, had never gone to college. In the early days, my dad made tires at you know, Goodyear tire factory. I didn't come from a family of, you know, lawyers and bankers and doctors and so forth. So I always had this kind of working class perspective. And so maybe I was just looking at things in a way that maybe other people didn't want to see or didn't have, you know, the inclination to see, or who knows.
It's funny because I can imagine that as somebody, I'm also from a working class background, and I can imagine I very much relate to this tension where on one hand you can very much recognize the inequity and the indignity that are produced by the system, but at the same time wanting to extract as much as possible from it as long as you can.
Oh yeah, let's get real. I mean, there were times when I was in college when I was homeless, and I never wanted my children to ever experience that. And so for me, the most important values I had was I wanted a paid off home, and I wanted to fully fund my kids' education as early as possible. So it was like an insurance policy for me. So, you know, I financed my oldest daughter's college education on two derivatives trades. It's like, okay, did I earn that money? I mean, that's how we were compensated. You know, it would take an awful lot of hard manual labor and a lot of beers to pour in my dad's pub if I had to earn it the old fashioned way.
Well, I also, as somebody who has zero understanding of the banking world, I have no idea how much time goes into two derivative trade. If you told me that it takes 10 years to complete them, then
no. It's an unregulated, well, it's more regulated now after the 2008 crash. But in the days I was doing it, it's a completely unregulated market. It's a very lucrative business, suffice to say.
And in terms of when you decided that the traditional path was no longer cutting it for you, when did that happen?
Oh, well, you asked me about the question about a faith background. I had this kind of mystical experience in about 2003, and that was not it. That was not what set me off on this other trajectory. That's what said, oh my gosh, I think I see the world differently. And so I started reading theology, you know, after that experience. And so it was probably 7 or 8 years later that I actually decided to make the break to do something else. And I looked at my husband, I'm like, you know what? I want to write. You know, I go back all these years ago, you know, where we started this conversation, I said, I want to write, and I want to write something important. He's like, well, what do you care about? What, you know, what's important to you? And during those intervening years, I had gotten a graduate degree in theology. I told you I was reading, like I had this mystical experience and I started reading. Well, I had some advice on what to read. So I was taking one-off theology courses and ended up with a graduate degree in theology. And I thought, you know, I want to know what God has to say about the nature of work and the responsibilities of wealth. My husband looked at me, he's like, okay. He's like, well, where are you going to do that? I'm like, I have no idea. And so my graduate training, I have graduate degrees in political science, finance, and theology. I'm like, well, how do I put all of those together? And are those the right disciplines? So I thought, you know, a PhD in any one of those subject areas was not going to afford me what I thought were the answers. And so I did a lot of homework, and I found a program at Georgetown University here in Washington that offered an interdisciplinary doctorate. And I'm like, that's it. This is where I'm going. Well, I had no idea how perfect of a place Georgetown was going to be to work on issues like this. And so I spent 5 years there, and I studied in a discipline called liberal studies. And I wrote this enormous dissertation. It wasn't enormous in terms of pages. It was probably 160 pages, but it was enormous in big ideas. And so what I wanted to do was to, once I felt I thought I understood with what a Catholic theological perspective was, because I come from the Catholic faith tradition, not originally, that's a whole nother story, but I wanted to say, okay, if I have a handle on this, what does it mean? And so that took me to a place called contributive justice theory, which is a emerging theory of justice or a dimension of how we understand justice that has roots in a variety of different disciplines. And there are all kinds of ways of understanding it. So I said, well, maybe my contribution, no pun intended, is to come up with a definition of contributive justice that's rooted in this theological perspective, and then think about what it might mean in the world. And so that was my project. And so during all that time, I was affiliated with a center at Georgetown that studies issues related to labor and the working poor. And they said, look, we're going to give you some resources and you can do whatever you want. And so that's what was the impetus for starting the podcast. And we've got some very varied people you'd never imagine on a business show, come to our show. So I had Raj Sisodia, who is the father of conscious capitalism. He and John Mackey from Whole Foods started the conscious capitalism movement. And it's this movement among CEOs who, are ostensibly the leaders of the culture of their companies that said, we need to have a consciousness of what we're doing. So I think there are, companies that are, coming around and, I look back in those early 90s days, to find social purpose organizations, they had to be quote unquote nonprofit. Well, those days have been transcended, which I think I'm very grateful for. I didn't imagine that I'd see it in my, working career, but they're here. And I think it's a trend that's not going away.
There is a growing demand coming from, I suppose, both shareholders in certain companies and also the C-suite world to become more conscientious, and you have forums like Market World, you have Portfolios with Purpose, you have all those groups. But what do we actually see results out of this, or are we seeing just pricked up language and slightly beatified mission statements that end up just giving cover to the same profit motive?
Yes, yes, and yes. There is a great hope in the idea of having a social purpose to business. There are good and well-intentioned efforts that are done by very large corporations who print these glossy reports that say, this is our social responsibility report, much in a way they might report their financial earnings, but they're doing it in a way to tell the story of the good in the world that their company's doing. Is that a whitewash? I would say in some cases, yes. I mean, when I hear Chevron talking about, environmental stewardship, I just want to cringe. You listen to our pilot episode, of the first season of our show, we had a shareholder activist who led a team of activist investors at the spring shareholder meeting last year of Chevron, who had a $9 billion liability for pollution of the Ecuadorian Amazon by their predecessor company, Texaco. And they've spent billions of dollars trying to get out of it. And it's like, maybe you just think people are going to forget, but you've got shareholders who own equity in your company that are telling you to do the right thing. And hey, that is a whole new world. So I hold hope that it's going to be a lot of outside pressures. And ultimately, I think pressures from the investors that are going to drive more of the behavior, investors and consumers, because consumers are becoming much more conscious of where they spend their money. And a lot of that has to do with transparency, either transparency that the company is voluntarily offering because they think they tell a good story, or transparency by third-party organizations that are doing the hard work of uncovering a lot of really bad behavior.
Full disclosure, I'm a very glowing capitalist, to the vexation of my friends. And yet I am also very open to the idea that some of the problems of inequality that plague us are are systemic in the true sense, in the way that we have it. This is not just corruption of an aggregate of companies, but there is a deeper culture of behavior that is facilitating that. And that is not to say that abandon the free market and start planning the economy, but it does mean that changes require more than the few angels that decide to act kindly or adapt a more moralistic language.
Oh, I agree with you. And I think a lot of it has to do with the exploitation and commodification of labor. When, you know, the objective is to squeeze out the last ounce of economic value in, you know, in a process of selling a good or a service, what gets cut? You know, ultimately, it's those costs of labor, or it could be things like safety or quality of the products. I mean, you know, we have operated in this country and largely globally for many several generations of business people have, you know, been educated with this philosophy that shareholder value means solely economic value. And I love the story. Again, I go back to this Chevron activist case where those shareholders said, wait a second, we're standing up because we think that it is in the long-term shared economic value to do the right thing. And when you have that change in perspective where value means more than just economic efficiency, you know, you start to look at making different decisions.
Of course, the question is, will they still be making that same point when the bottom line is actually starting to take a real hit?
Right.
Oh yeah, it's a problem. It's a big problem. I mean, so you have to start looking at, you know, what are those systemic levers that cause this behavior. You know, a lot of it has to do with executive compensation, how executives are compensated within the corporate structure, how corporations are governed. You know, those are pivot points that can start to begin to change behavior.
I hope that this movement that I see happening in business is going to make a big difference, because I do think that, you know, companies have tremendous power that they could exert and make real positive impact on this world. And in fact, if they don't, they're going to have an outsized negative impact. That said, I am skeptical that it's going to actually happen in a meaningful way. And part of my skepticism is rooted in the private sector's relationship to the public sector and when you need to kind of regulate strictly to enforce behavior versus how much is going to come naturally from the private sector kind of understanding that, hey, long term, we're not going to have a planet to sell with people to sell products to if we don't change our behavior. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to get your take on what should the relationship between private and public sector be if we're going to be able to have a capitalistic societies that are okay for the and good for the planet.
No, I think that's a very important observation. I interviewed for season two a congressman Andy Levin. He is from the 9th District of Michigan, comes from this iconic political family in Michigan, and introduced a piece of legislation related to the desire to put in place a requirement for fiduciaries of investment funds to take into account an investment policy that has a philosophy or an approach towards responsible investing. And so he's not saying that Congress should mandate that pension plan fiduciaries invest in, we call it ESG, environmental, social, and governance attributes, that they are mandated to do so. But his legislation says that these fiduciaries should be mandated to at least consider it. And so they should have investment policies in place that stipulate exactly how they're going to approach the review and consideration of these types of investments. And if that can get passed, it would be huge.
He wrote a whole dissertation about what God has to say about, you know, the responsibility of wealth and work. And I want to know, you know, TLDR, what does God have to say about it?
All right. What do I see as the answer? I think, you know, you get a different answer, whatever theologian you talk to. But the way I was able to understand it was I wanted to start out by thinking about who we are as human beings. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King called us co-workers with God. You know, the story of the Garden of Eden and God commissioning mankind to work. So work was given to us as a way to help dignify us. And that's where I think Dr. King was going with this idea of being a co-worker with God, being able to transform creation to the glory of God. So that's where I started, was this idea of man being a co-creator with God. And so in that social tradition of the church, there's this concept called the universal destination of goods. It's this idea that the earth was created for the benefit of everyone. And so you start thinking about, when does private property come into effect? To balance that out, there's this concept called the social mortgage. You're familiar with the concept of a mortgage, right? Where you have, let's say, a piece of real estate where you don't have all of the money to buy it outright. So you don't have total, complete private ownership of it. You share that ownership with some lender. Well, in the social mortgage within Catholic social teaching, it's this idea that the goods of the earth have a social mortgage put on them. So we owe mankind for the use of those resources. You can imagine how that would roll out in practicality, but it underlines this concept that we owe each other something, a duty of sharing or a duty of support, or a duty of safety, all kinds of things are wrapped up into that. And so you have these kind of property level, you know, issues. But when you think about it in terms of the human person, the bottom line of all of this is that we are called to flourish. From a theological perspective, flourishing really means the beatific vision, being in the presence and seeing God, being one with God. And so if that's our ultimate goal as human beings, how do we get there? By interacting with, you know, the forces in the world. There are two competing drivers. One is this idea of solidarity, charity, or love. And then that's balanced with this idea of subsidiarity, which is the idea that we should live in societies or in communities or in families or in relationships where the decision making is done at the lowest level, competent enough to make that decision. So it really is a way to understand human agency so as not to rob others of agency.
I'm stuck still at the earliest stage. I am a theology skeptic. Mm-hmm. I'm very much into the literature of religion, but when it comes to trying to understand the world through divinity, I have my innate skepticism.
That's right. Well, that's the thing. I joke around with my Jesuit friends. I'm like, you know what? I try to talk about things without the God talk, because sometimes it puts up a wall. So I respect and understand where you're coming from.
So I do want to understand the philosophy behind it. Nature itself is there for us to use, right? There for us to extract value from. Okay. The question is, how does it get distributed and how do we justify uneven distribution, right? That's where the tensions start arising.
Yes. And that's actually, I'm glad you have that perception, because that's what this concept of contributive justice is really all about. It's this dimension of justice, of how I understand it, is that there's both this obligation to contribute one's own resources, whether they're material or spiritual resources, you know, your time, attention, love, you know, all of those things, your obligation to do that. But also you should have a right to be able to do that. So think about how people are in so many ways marginalized or discriminated against. Those are what I would understand as contributive injustices, those impediments that cause problems for people to be able to live out who they are. You know, some of the issues that you're hinting at are what I understand as preconditions to a contributively just world. You know, what are those, you know, preconditions? You know, they're things like having an adequate education or having access to an education, with you having the agency to choose whether or not you take advantage of that, adequate nutrition and healthcare, a safe community, all those things that need to be in place before you can, you know, get up to live another day. And so think about all the ways that societies are built that either foster that or in some ways leave it to the markets or to chance or to good fortune or whatever. You know, I see those as being very problematic.
How do we understand the current state of our country, of America, being a place that is one of the most Christian countries in the world, which means, like you said, the founded on this idea of love and solidarity, being also one of the most unequal countries in, at least in the Western world, and that doesn't only perpetuate inequality, but to some extent relishes.
Oh, Adam, I think in a lot of ways, you know, we've done a really crappy job of being a Christian country. I can't remember who said it, but it's like, I'd be Christian if I'd ever met one. I think we have aspirations, but I, you know, and a lot of room for growth.
Dawn, thank you so much for playing along.
Thank you.
No, thanks. It was fun.
You've been listening to What Does It Profit? And this week on Certain Things. If you're not already a What Does It Profit podcast subscriber, just press the button so you don't miss a thing. And if you want to join a cool community of hip intellectuals, subscribe to Uncertain Things wherever you listen to podcasts. Next time on What Does It Profit, we're going to look back on a conversation with Lisa Mensa of the Opportunity Finance Network. I'll draw out some of the important insights and share with you what's been going on in the community development finance world as the financial first responders have been dealing with the ravages of a global pandemic and the continued calls for economic justice. In the meantime, we urge you to connect with our show page on LinkedIn to meet other What Does It Profit podcast listeners. And follow us on Twitter at WDIP Podcast as we spend these next few months building out our community on all the other social platforms. What Does It Profit is written and hosted by me, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. This episode was edited and produced by Jordan Gosperé and recorded at Switch and Board Studios. Again, special thanks to our friends at Uncertain Things. To learn more about the show and see our long and illustrious group of friends and supporters, check out our website, whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. And as always, before I let you go, let me remind you to never stop asking yourself, what does it profit?